Thank you for joining us on the Future Food Show. We're really excited to have Paul Shapiro back on the show. I want to say episode number 3. Paul, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Alex. I feel like I'm like Tom Brady three-peating on this podcast. I'm so honored.
It is number 3, right? Because I think we've talked about having you on 3 times. Is this 3 or 4?
I wish that I remembered that. I should have looked it up. But I'm either way, I'm psyched to be on. It's a great show. I listen to every episode that you put out, so I'm very grateful to be on as a guest.
You do listen to every episode, and I know that because you always follow up on every episode, and it's so nice for me to see that, and also, I think, really cool for the guests. So I want to thank you for that.
Yeah, of course. It's a great resource for information about the space and what companies are doing. That's cool. And as somebody who continues to write about the space, I view it as a very valuable resource. So hopefully this episode will also be a valuable resource for somebody else too.
I'm sure it will be. And it's, you know, I think there's no problem in not knowing whether this is episode 3 or 4. I'm pretty sure it's 3, but because the first episode was recorded back in 2018, it's kind of crazy to even think about that.
What a different world it was. You know, when we recorded that episode, there were probably half a dozen companies on the planet that were trying to commercialize real meat slaughter-free. It was a really big deal if a company got a $1 or $2 million investment. Even when Cargill put like $500,000 into a company, it was this really amazing deal. We thought, wow, I can't believe that the industry is not only not fighting it, but is actually embracing it. Of course, now there's more than 150 companies in the space. There have been several $1 billion invested. And so I think, you know, if you look at that time frame of 6 years, that's a lot of progress. I mean, even the, like, if you look at the cost to produce cultivated meat, you know, back then, you know, when Mark Post made that 2013 cultivated burger, it was $330,000 per quarter pounder. People think that's the per pound price. That's the per quarter pound price. And now people are talking about making, you know, $10 or even $100 burgers. So those are still too expensive, but it's a lot cheaper than it was. So hopefully that trajectory will keep on going. Yet at the same time, while there's a lot of progress that's been made, I think if you had asked me in 2018, would there be any meaningful commercialization of cultivated meat by 2024? I probably would have said I thought that that would be the case. And indeed, there hasn't been. So there are some ways that I think there's been enormous progress, but in others, you know, it has been, maybe the predictions were too optimistic back then.
Well, I want to joke that that $300K does not even account for inflation. So it would be $500K for a quarter pound burger today.
That's really funny. I wonder if that's true. So I'll look it up real quick. So in 2013, it is $440,000 in 2024 numbers. So yeah.
Wow.
The $440,000 burger. That's really funny.
So I was reading through some of the pages of my copy, and I want to say that back in 2018, it just was still called Hampton Creek. I don't think they had even changed, you know, changed their name or rebranded yet.
Yeah, when the book was, you know, really written in 2016 and 17, it came out in January of 2018. And by the time it had come out, I think they had just changed their name. So there wasn't enough time to switch the name from Hampton Creek to Eat Just. That was actually, you know, in writing the updated edition of Clean Meat, that was actually like a kind of a nuisance, as all these companies have changed their names. So it's like Memphis Meats is now Upside Foods. Hampton Creek is now Eat Just. Clara Foods is now the Every Company. It's like all these companies, nobody was content with their names from back then. So it presented a little bit of a challenge in the case of the book. But the new book, which really has a lot of updated material, and it does account for those name changes.
Well, it wasn't just the companies that changed their names, because, you know, as an industry, we were calling this technology clean meat back then. It has gone through several different changes. And, you know, now the industry refers to it as cultivated meat. But when I hear clean meat, I always think about your book. And, you know, of course, the book keeps the title, which is actually kind of nice.
It's funny you say that. You made a comment about this to me recently. That today, when people were talking about Queen Meat, they're usually talking about the book, not the actual topic. But I will say, like, if you have a Google News alert for the term Queen Meat, you actually do get a number of hits for news articles that are still referring to it as Queen Meat in some iteration. But yes, that is obviously a topic of discussion in the new book is nomenclature. And there was a little, like, at the time of the book's writing, the main debate among proponents of this technology was really cultured meat versus clean meat. And after the book came out, what essentially happened was the meat industry was getting more and more involved in the space, both through investments and other collaborations. And some of those meat trade associations were offended by the term clean meat, as you can imagine. I mean, oil companies don't like the term clean energy, obviously, because it implies that their product is dirty. And so you had some companies that had taken investment from these meat companies who were particularly sensitive to their concern about being offended by this term. And so they proposed changing it to cell-based meat. And I still remember at the 2018 Good Food Conference in September of 2018, there was like a big huddle of the various budding companies in this industry. And not all, but some of them did agree to change it to cell-based to accommodate this concern. And, you know, the idea was there are three categories of meat: plant-based meat and animal-based meat, and now cell-based meat. The problem is that, you know, first of all, it's not very descriptive because all meat is cell-based, whether it's made from soybeans or made from animals or made from slaughtered animals or whatever, like it's still coming from cells. And second, there is the problem that cell-based meat just sounds very foreign and very unappealing to people. It consistently performs poorly among favorability in polling. It does perform in polling well when you ask for what term makes this sound the most differentiated from conventional meat. But when you ask about actual favorability of the term, meaning, you know, willingness to purchase, interest in trying it, it rates very poorly. And that's because nobody wants to eat cells, right? Obviously, everything we eat is made of cells for the most part, but nobody wants to eat cells. It sounds disgusting. You know, people like science to be in their phones, but not necessarily in their food. And so there was a backlash against this term for many of the companies in the space that felt like things had gone too far on this term, that it had gone from a very positive term, clean meat, which polled very favorably among consumers, to now one that was not neutral, but was rather negative. It almost sounded pejorative. It's not as bad as lab-grown meat, but still pretty bad. And so that's why the Good Food Institute ran some studies and basically found that cultivated meat was perceived either neutrally or somewhat positively compared to cell-based meat. It didn't perform as well as clean meat, but still, considering the concerns that people had about offending the meat industry, it was something that was switched to. And so now you have near total unanimity within the industry, at least among the English-speaking countries where companies are based, of using the term cultivated meat. And so the question was, you know, should I change the title of the book, which first of all is a very difficult thing to do, to change a title of a book. But second, I'm not so sure that people shouldn't use clean meat. It polls extremely favorably, better than others. It's accurate in that it is literally cleaner from a food safety perspective. You know, when you're slaughtering animals, you have to treat the meat almost like toxic waste. You know, like you have to separate meat in your grocery basket. If it touches your kitchen counter, you need to disinfect it. If it touches your hands, you need to wash your hands. That's because the meat literally has feces on it, like Salmonella, E. coli, Campylobacter. These are intestinal pathogens that can sicken us if we don't cook the crap out of the meat, literally cooking the crap out of the meat. But with clean meat or cultivated meat, you don't have to worry so much about those intestinal pathogens because you're not growing the intestines at all. You're growing the muscle or the fat, and you don't have as much worry about intestinal pathogens. You're more likely probably to infect the meat with your own hands than it is to infect you. So from a food safety perspective, it's accurate, and it's an allusion to clean energy, clean meat. So I'm not, you know, on a crusade to have people change the term back to clean meat or anything. I think that's up to the companies that are marketing it themselves. But I didn't want to change the title because I frankly think it's a provocative title that is likely to, you know, evoke interest in readers. So that's why it remained the same. It's a good book title.
I think this is a good point actually to kind of stop and reintroduce the book, because we are actually seeing a new wave of listeners starting to come on the show. I'm hoping that this episode will be one of the first episodes that somebody who is just hearing about this technology listens to. So can you give us a general introduction to actually the book, Clean Meat, and maybe not so much about the updates, but just the book in general?
Yeah, sure. So this is the first book that came out on this topic, and it's called Clean Meat, How Growing Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner in the World. Simon & Schuster put it out in 2018. And, you know, essentially the book chronicles the race between the entrepreneurs, the scientists, and the investors who are all, again, racing to commercialize the world's first slaughter-free meat. And so the book tells the history of the cellular agriculture movement. It's not a science book. It's really more of like a pop science or a pop business book, which tells the story of the people behind this industry. Everything going back literally to the 1800s when people were writing about this, to the 1930s when people like Churchill were writing about it, to, you know, around the year 2000 when people started actually making it with a NASA-funded grant to grow goldfish muscle outside of the goldfish, to Willem van Eeuwen's crusade to try to commercialize this and getting the world's first ever patent on this, all the way up to companies actually being founded to commercialize this product. And so the book, frankly, did better than I would have dreamt. I didn't know what type of a reaction it would get. I had never published a book. There was some level of hubris in writing it, but I was very grateful that Simon & Schuster purchased the book. And it debuted on the Washington Post bestsellers list, outselling a lot of really popular books by people like Ray Dalio and Neil deGrasse Tyson that week that it came out in January of 2018. Got really good reviews in the Wall Street Journal and NPR. And the book, again, was, you know, it did a lot better than I would have dreamt. And it was transformative in my own life because it essentially offered me two pathways in my life. The first was I could keep on writing about the people who I thought were going to solve this problem that has animated my own life for the last 30 years, which is how to wean humanity off of our animal-based diet. And I could keep on writing about those people, or I could just become one of them. And ultimately, I chose the latter and ended up starting my own alternative protein company called The Better Meat Co., which does not do cultivated animal cells, but rather does mycoprotein-based fermentations. But it really had a transformative effect on my life, and I'm proud to say on a lot of other people's lives. I still hear regularly from people, even 6 years after the publication, that they invested in a company, or they started their own company, or they joined a company because of reading this book. And so, you know, I often think that fiction generally is more compelling than nonfiction. Like it's very rare that you hear of nonfiction books that change people's lives. It happens for sure, but it's very easy to think about books. It's very easy to think about novels that had a transformative effect on people. Brave New World, Animal Farm, 1984, Fahrenheit 451. Even on the right, you have people say like Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged really had a transformative effect on their psychology. But it's hard to think about nonfiction books that really change a lot of people's lives. But just on the feedback that I get, which is of course anecdotal, but I've really heard from so many people now, again, even to this very day in 2024, were people who have told me that, you know, their lives were impacted by this and their career choices were impacted by it. And that is something of which I'm very proud. I really hope that I have helped to popularize this movement to create alternatives to the slaughter-based animal meat system that we have right now.
Well, you definitely have. And I mean, another data point is us starting not only this podcast, incorporating SVCMS or the Silicon Valley Cultured Meat Symposium to host events about the topic. And then eventually, you know, Anita and I went on, really Anita's brainchild, to create Balletic Food. So in many ways, you have a data point right here. A little bit funny that both Better Meat Co. and Balletic are not cultured meat. I wanted to ask you, when you were writing Clean Meat, did you think that you would start either an alternative protein company or a cultivated meat company?
You know, it's such a good point. It's such a good question. So, you know, when I was writing it, my only goal was to help inform and popularize this space. I was really concerned that, you don't get a second chance to make a first impression. And I was very concerned that maybe the first impression people would get of this industry would be from its detractors, people who were actually trying to bury this very, very nascent industry while it's still in the cradle, or I mean, maybe even in that case, still in the womb. And so that was my number one goal, was to bring to life the stories and the motivations of the people who are actually waging this movement to try to divorce animal slaughter from meat. And so I think I accomplished that goal in telling their stories. And because this was really the first book on the topic and the best-selling book on the topic still today, I think I did accomplish that. However, I knew that I was already becoming persuaded of my own thesis, and really like a thesis of the book, is that technology is needed to wean ourselves off of the factory farming of animals. You know, it'd be great if people wanted to, you know, switch to bean and rice burritos and lentil soup and hummus wraps. I love those foods. I wish more people would eat them, but people want meat. You know, meat demand is rising all around the world for the most part, and we have to give them meat. It'd be kind of like saying, oh, wouldn't it be great if people would just walk and bike more? Well, you know, people seem to really like to drive, so it's pretty important that we make cars that don't rely on fossil fuels. And so, you know, I looked at the history of how we have stopped exploiting animals for other purposes, and pretty much every single time, it's because a new invention rendered the old way obsolete. You know, we used to whip horses in order to get around for thousands of years. That was the fastest mode of transport. And nobody stopped abusing horses for transportation or labor because they cared about horses. They stopped because the internal combustion engine was invented. Similarly, we used to harpoon whales in order to get our lighting. And, you know, the main reason why we stopped harpooning whales was because new methods of lighting were invented, primarily kerosene followed by electricity, that were just cleaner and more efficient than whale oil was. You know, we used to have to live pluck geese for thousands of years. That was how we made pens. And, you know, people wrote with goose quills. And it's a very torturous thing to do. And nobody stopped live plucking geese because they cared about geese. They stopped because metal fountain pens were invented, and it was a much more efficient way to write. You didn't have to stop and dip your quill into an inkwell. You didn't have to constantly sharpen the quill tip. It was just a much better way to write. And so that's three categories of animal exploitation that had been around literally for millennia each that were displaced within a very short time frame by a new technology. And then if you try to think about, well, where are there cases of animal exploitation that were ended because of humane sentiment, which is what I had devoted my career to prior for a couple decades prior to writing this book? It's pretty hard to find any example of that. It's like really hard to think of any whole category of entrenched animal exploitation that was essentially eradicated by humane sentiment. And I'm not saying it can't happen. I'm just saying it's pretty hard to think of any examples of it. And so I was already persuaded of my own thesis that while I thought humane campaigns were very important and very valuable, that we really needed more technology and innovation that could render some of these exploitative systems obsolete. And as a result, I thought, yeah, maybe I will join or start a company in this space. Maybe I'll just write about the space and popularize it. I wasn't really sure what I was going to do after the book tour. And it seemed very plausible to me that I would continue writing about it, given how the book performed. But I wasn't really sure. And I frankly, you know, came to the belief that, you know, these people who are starting companies, to me, they seemed, you know, almost like on a different level, right? Like, and I was like, well, I don't, you know, have an MBA from Harvard. I wasn't a microbiologist or a tissue engineer. I didn't have millions of dollars to invest in venture capital. Like, I was just basically an animal advocate who had devoted myself to public policy lobbying for a very long time. But as I wrote the book and continued interviewing the people who had started these companies, it became very clear to me that they were not somehow super people, that they were just mere mortals like myself. And many of them seemed to have not that much experience before they started their companies. And so ironically, in writing this book, they became far more human to me. And that gave me the assurance that maybe I could start my own company. And whether that was a good idea or not, you know, time will tell. But I'm glad to have started a company. I've been running the Better Meat Co. for the last 6 years. And I feel extremely grateful to have had this continuing experience of building something from nothing and seeing a new technology develop that I think could really go a very long way toward helping to solve this problem. And to answer your question directly about, you know, whether I thought I would start a cultivated animal product company, frankly, the reason that I didn't was because in writing the book, it became extremely clear to me that this was not a technology that was going to be making a meaningful dent in the problem in the extremely near term. You know, even the most wildly optimistic predictions for cultivated meat suggest now that, you know, maybe it'll be in grocery stores by 2030. So, you know, that's what Upside Foods says. You know, their COO, Amy Chen, said in a recent interview, they expect to be on grocery store shelves by the year 2030. And so, you know, even that, you know, you have to ask yourself, well, when will it be 1% of the meat demand that there is? I mean, even plant-based meat, which has a much greater head start, is not even at 1% of total animal meat demand in the United States or the world yet, despite the fact that it's in every grocery store and, you know, every big box grocery store, and it's on fast food menus and so on. You know, plant-based meat is still not there. Now, you know, you could argue, well, when cultivated meat is made widely available, it's going to be so much better than plant-based meat from a sensory perspective that it'll catch like fire. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. That'd be wonderful if that happened. But even under, you know, if you look at the projections of the most well-funded companies in the space, you know, they say that, you know, by 2030, they hope to have these factories that will be producing a few tens of millions of pounds of product every year. Even if their projections turn out to be true, you know, let's say, you know, 30, 50, even 100 million pounds of meat. I mean, you know, there's 100 billion pounds of meat produced in the United States alone every year. So, you know, you're talking about a rounding error in the total meat industry. And so that's why I ended up, while writing a book about cultivated meat, that I'm extremely enthusiastic about the future of the cultivated meat industry. I think of it more as making a dent in the further future than I do for what I'm doing, which is mycoprotein fermentation, which is ready to scale today. In fact, one company, Qorn, Q-U-O-R-N, has already scaled it and is already producing food that they make hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue from annually from bioreactors. You know, I mean, if you go to Qorn's headquarters in the UK, they've got, you know, a whole slew of 150,000 liter bioreactors that are 40 meters tall. It's like 120 feet tall, churning out over 100 SKUs of product that are microbially based. So it's not animal cells, but you know, it is an amazing feat of biotechnology meeting the food industry. You know, people talk about this technology hasn't scaled, we don't have these huge bioreactors. Well, for fungi fermentation, you do. Like Qorn is already doing it. You know, 150,000 liter reactors that have been running literally for decades now. And so that gave me the hope that maybe with mycoprotein fermentation, it was more immediately scalable and that we could come up with something that was different than what Qorn was doing by using different organisms and different processes and different business models and create something important. And so I love Qorn. I think it's a great company and I eat their products. And I hope that what Better Meat Co. is doing augments what they're doing by creating new culinary experiences from microbial fungi.
I want to ask you about kind of like the origin story of the book, because you were mentioning that there are certain, you know, historic novels that have made big impacts in the world. You know, your book Clean Meat has definitely with those in the industry, those who I've grown to know, made a big impact for them. But the origin story of the book, I think you once told me that you originally started writing actually a novel about the technology. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that transitioned to kind of, and I like the way you said it, it was kind of like a sci-fi business type of book, or how did you describe it?
Yeah, I want to say, yeah. So first, let me say, yes, you're absolutely right. I did actually write a novel about the human-animal relationship, and I still hope to publish it. But in short, nobody would publish it at the time when I wrote this thing in like 2015 and 16. And I was really, you know, I wrote this, it was like the original manuscript was like 100,000 words. So I'd really like poured myself into this thing. And I really thought I had like these aspirations of the book really succeeding. Unfortunately, it didn't succeed. Literally not one publisher took it. And I did a lot of publisher meetings. And I kept hearing from publishers, you know, to the extent that anybody knows who you are, they don't want to read fiction from you. They want to read nonfiction from you. So if you have a nonfiction proposal, let us know. And, you know, I really wanted to publish this novel. In fact, I still really want to publish the novel. But I thought, okay, well, what's the most important thing that no one else is writing about that I believe would do good for animals on the planet? And I came up with a list of ideas. And this one was definitely, I thought, the one that interested me the most. And I didn't even put it on the list myself. One day after work in Maryland, I went for a run with my then colleague, whose name is Kenny Torella, who now is a writer for Vox Media. But we were running together through the woods, and I was telling him about my idea to maybe write a nonfiction book. And he said, why don't you put something on lab-grown meat on there? Wouldn't that be cool? And I'd been a champion for this technology for a long time. In fact, I had known Jason Matheny, who was the original founder of New Harvest, since before he even founded New Harvest. And I had been interviewed for a number of publications about my point of view on this topic. So I was already accustomed to speaking about it publicly. But I thought, yeah, you know, nobody's written a book on this. I think, yeah, maybe there is something here and I could tell these stories. And so I wrote up like a 10,000 word proposal, which was essentially, you know, an outline and a sample chapter. And, you know, this is going to be a gross oversimplification of what actually happened, but Simon & Schuster bought it and published it. And so I got very fortunate. You know, I had never published a book before. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't have any experience in this realm. And my only experience even writing a book was failure, essentially. Since then, I have actually gone back and dramatically revised that novel. So now it's like around 70,000 words. And I think it's a very good novel. I really hope to publish it one day. So if somebody listening to this interview is in the publishing industry or knows somebody, you know, I would really love to get that in the world. In fact, I told my wife, she was asking me what I hope to achieve before I die still. And I said, I don't want to die without this novel being published. I'd really love to see it. So anyway, if you're listening and you want to take a look, I'd be very happy to talk with you about it.
Well, I wish we had enough listeners to say that we could put a call out for crowdfunding. So if everybody contributes $1, no.
It's not the money, it's the publisher, right? Like I could self-publish it. My concern is that, you know, not that many people would see it. You know, most self-published books don't get read that much. But when you have like a publisher, I mean, even just an example, like, you know, Simon & Schuster for the upcoming updated paperback edition of Queen Meat, you know, they're running all types of publicity for it. Right now, there's a contest on Goodreads where people can enter the contest and they're going to give away a free 40 copies. And I just looked at it today and over 1,000 people have entered the contest so far. So, you know, it's hard to go it alone. There are examples of self-published books that do well. That certainly happens, but they're anomalous. It's rare that self-published books do very well.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for this technology and educating people about the technology, also just the amount of distribution, like you can really pick up, aside from Amazon, you could pick up Clean Meat in pretty much every bookstore, right? Or you know, most bookstores in the US. And so maybe this is actually a good transition to the update. So, you know, tell us exactly when the new update will be released and where to get it or pre-order it.
Cool. Yeah, it's going to come out on April 9th, 2024, and it is available anywhere the books are sold. So you can pre-order it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever books are sold. And it's an updated paperback edition. So if you get the hard copy, you'll still get the 2018 edition. But if you get the paperback, you'll get the 2024 edition. And the updates are manifold. They're not only looking at just, you know, updated stories about companies in the space, but there are sections about the nomenclature debate, about the regulatory approvals, about the first sales of the product, about controversies over FBS or fetal bovine serum and its elimination. It's a section about the very widely discussed counter story that came out a few years ago, essentially writing the obituary for this industry. And so, you know, the updated edition was completed in the summer of 2023. So it does not include, you know, things like the very recent New York Times obituary, which was written by the same person who wrote that counter obituary a few years ago. But it is a much updated version of the 2018 edition. And so even if you read the 2018 edition 6 years ago, I think it's highly worth reading the new edition for sure. But I think there's probably a lot of people who have entered the space, since it's a much larger space, who maybe haven't read the first edition and will benefit more from reading the second edition than the first. But the book still does tell the story about the history of cellular agriculture. And I think that in and of itself is an evergreen story that is constantly being written as the world continues turning and more developments occur. But somebody needs to tell the story about how this industry even came to be. And that's really the goal of this book.
as somebody who might be picking it up for the first time, you know, what should that reader do after finishing the book? Is there any kind of, you know, call to action that, you know, you would be very pleased that, you know, they would move forward and do after reading it? And before you answer, I want to, you know, I want to read actually the dedication you have in the original book, which reads, "Dedicated to every person who sees an apparently intractable problem and sets about laboring tirelessly to solve it. Confident in the words of Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done." So any actions, call to action you'd like a reader to make after finishing the book?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Alex. So obviously the best thing after finishing the book is to buy several copies for your friends and family. But after you've done that, my hope is that people will become advocates for this industry, both cultivated meat and other alternative proteins. This is not a book that is meant merely to entertain and inform, though I do think it does both of those things, but also to inspire, and to inspire people to take action. Maybe they'll invest in one of these companies. Maybe they'll join one of these companies. Maybe they'll start one of their own companies. Maybe they're a news journalist who wants to cover this space. Maybe they're a regulator who now understands the space better than they might have otherwise understood it. There's a whole host of ways. You know, maybe you're just somebody who's going to promote the space online to your friends and family so that the first time they hear about this type of technology, they don't say yuck, but rather they say yum. There's a whole host of things that you can do, from very minor, like posting on social media, to more major, which are career changing or at least maybe in some way altering the course of your life. So that's what I hope will happen, that the book will inform, it'll entertain, and it will inspire. And I feel confident that the first edition of the book did that. And I'm very hopeful that the second edition does that too.
Excellent. I'd like to add one to that list, maybe start a podcast on the topic as well, because we do need more.
Nice. Yeah, no, that's good. You know, I heard that Doug Grant's podcast, Brave New Meat, is no longer publishing. So that's a shame. This is a great podcast, obviously. And I will note that on the podcast that I host and that I've been hosting for the last 6 years, which is called the Business for Good podcast, I'm currently doing an entirely cultivated meat series, where it'll be about 10 episodes in a row, where they're going to drop weekly on Fridays. Already two of them are out, which was with Josh Tetrick, the CEO of Good Meat, and Nia Gupta, the CEO of Fork and Good. We've got Mark Post, the CEO of Mosa Meat, Isha Tatar from New Harvest, Uma Valetti, and a whole host of other people who are going to be on this series talking about the way that they see this industry. Because, you know, the headlines are quite negative right now. There's a lot of malaise around the space, and investors are pulling back from this space right now, at least, you know, hopefully only temporarily. But I wanted to offer a chance to the leaders in the cultivated meat movement to give their own perspective in their own words, not in sound bites or one sentence in a news story, but rather for, you know, 30 or 40 minute conversation to give their thoughts about what's happening in the space, what's still needed in order to succeed and to scale, and what do they think about the claim. I mean, because, you know, there's really two detractors of this industry now. There's the detractors who say this can never work. Right? There's people who say, like, this technology just cannot work, and so this is a waste of time and resources. And then there's another set of detractors who say this is such a threat to the current meat industry that we ought to try to ban it. And that's why you see states like Florida actually passing legislation literally to criminalize the sale of these products. So, you know, these are two interesting sets of detractors. One who says this isn't a threat, it's never going to succeed. And the others who said we think it is such a threat that we want to pass laws banning it. And so I think it's far less compelling to hear the founders in this space talking about that latter, you know, talking about, you know, what's happening in Florida. Obviously, they're going to decry those efforts. But the real question that I am very eager to hear them answer is whether they think it's true that this just can't scale. Now, maybe they're rationalizing, you know, their own companies and saying, no, it can scale. But it's still interesting to hear them, after years of working and raising, you know, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars each, to ask them, you know, is there anything that you've learned that makes you feel like it can't scale? Like, do you think maybe it won't work? And so I'm eager to release all of these episodes and let people hear from the founders themselves.
I'm definitely excited to listen. And wherever you are currently listening to this episode, take a look at the description. The link to Business for Good podcast, along with Paul Shapiro's profile, will be right there. Paul, I wanted to ask you, as we close up, do you have any last insights or thoughts for our listeners today?
you know, it's actually is in the vein of the quote from Nelson Mandela that you read a few minutes ago, that it always seems impossible until it's done. You know, people were writing obituaries for the electric vehicle 15 years ago, and it turned out it wasn't true. You know, electric vehicles are now increasingly in prominence, and you have a number of states that say, and even car companies that say they're going to phase out gas-powered cars. So, you know, something that 15 years ago went from being allegedly impossible to make work now appears to be inevitable. And that doesn't mean that the progress was self-executing. It doesn't mean, oh, electric cars were inevitable. It only happened because of the tireless work of so many people who worked and labored so hard to make new inventions and start companies that actually led to the world where anybody who's looking into the future knows that the future is going to be an electrified future for the vehicle industry. We don't know how long it will take, but anybody looking at it knows which way the wind is blowing. The same is happening right now for alternative meat. People are writing the obituaries for this industry, not just cultivated meat, but plant-based meat as well. And I would venture to say that those predictions of this industry's demise might be right and they might be wrong, but it is incumbent upon those of us who want those predictions to be wrong to work hard to ensure that we invent new technologies and we advocate for this industry so that we can one day get to a point where people will say the same thing, that you don't know how long it's going to take until we wean humanity off of our dependence and addiction to raising animals for food and factory farms, but we know which way the wind is blowing and we know what the future is going to hold. And that's going to mean a protein industry that is far less reliant on the exploitation of animals. That's what I'm working toward. I know that's probably, if you're listening to this podcast, that's what you're working toward. And I would only suggest that the progress is not and will not be self-executing. It is not enough simply to cheer from the sidelines, that we have to actually get on the field to play the game and to make progress and move the ball down the field so that we can get to a better future.
Thank you very much, Paul. Clean Meat, How Growing Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner and the World. Updated paperback edition being released on April 9th. Paul, thank you so much for being on the show.
It's my honor. Thanks so much, Alex.